Life Conversations Radio. Be the change you want to see.
Life Conversations is dedicated to empowering its listeners spiritually, emotionally, socially, and financially. The radio show provides the platform for the stimulation of thoughts, conversations, and ways of being that allow listeners to explore and examine what it is they believe and decide whether what they believe is keeping them stuck and disempowered or empowering them to live their best life.
Truly wish to. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to me in the car, your mommy and me, my and me. And the car, me too. Happy birthday to me. Let me press that.
Welcome to Play Experience. Yes, indeed, it's a happy birthday, happy anniversary. We're so excited. We are so excited right here from the land of Down Under. We're broadcasting to you live on this beautiful, auspicious moment. Yes, it is our birthday here on the Play Experience. Life Conversation Radio started out in the UK, where Isaiah and I started community radio in 1860. And we moved back to the States to continue to sing on Box Rock on the platform we're on right now. So this show, this Play Experience has been live here since 2011. So we are still a budding three-year-old just having a good time right here on this playground of life. Yes, indeed. Here to just serve up more life conversations. Conversations that will continually assist on your journey, on your life voyage. This wonderful moment. I am just really enamored right now because the person that is here on the playground with me has touched my heart in so many places. It means a whole lot to me that he is here. So without even, I'm gonna just do something right now. One of the pieces that he has given us is meaningful, very meaningful to me right now with me broadcasting from Australia. You know, I've been dealing with this time thing. It's 9 a.m.-ish here. And, you know, just this whole thing about time collapsing and what does it really mean. And this song, it always touched my heart since I think he came out with it in 2004, one of his many pieces. And, yes, you'll know who this mystery person is in a minute. I'm just going to give you some of the fullness of what I see. This piece is called Forever in a Moment. So I'm going to share this with you now, and then we'll be back, and you'll feel more fullness.
He has been a mentor to me. He was my first intro into the business of music. In fact, he gifted me with my very first book about this industry, this business of music. He's a true educator, and he does it through his sound. Jay Plunkett Branch is an experienced performer. He's a songwriter. You see how nervous I get? He's a mentor. I can't help it. He's a songwriter. He's a music and film producer. He's a giant, people. He's a giant. And he's a love, a powerful energy in my life. Like I said, he touches many parts of my heart. And I really love I'm going to move away from the bio because I'm going to let him tell you about you, him, and you through him. He is a powerful giant in this business of love and healing on this planet. And I asked him to come on the show today because of the ministry that he has in sound. I didn't even realize that it was the birthday of the show at the time when I initially asked him. But then I said, wow, let me check. So it really is an auspicious moment for me to have him here right now. And so I'm going to bring him front and center on the playground to share with us who he is, because he can tell us much better than I, obviously. Welcome, 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 my dear, wonderful brother, Plunky.
Thank you so much, Mbasa. It is my great pleasure to be with you and to share with you and your audience a bit about our music that we share and this time that we get to play on your playground.
Yes, indeed. This is a very, very important time for me. I tell you, I have been watching you over the years, and I've been watching just how you have really been ministering as a minister with music. It's just awesome. I've just been watching you throughout the Richmond area, the D.C. area, and then how you just take it around the globe. So first of all, I want to ask you what I ask everyone when they come on the playground: who is Plunky Branch?
J. Plunky Branch is a saxophonist and producer and performer and filmmaker from Richmond, Virginia, who believes that music is and should be more than mere entertainment, that music can be a bridge for us to share emotionally, socially, and culturally. I have devoted my music career, which has spanned more than 40 years now, to showing that music is spiritual and it is a resource for us to use to share love and also to have a good time, to play. I've had the opportunity, as you say, to work from my hometown of Richmond, Virginia, and to branch out from there to go to New York and San Francisco and Washington, D.C. And then over the years, I've had the opportunity to travel and tour in Europe, had the opportunity to go and perform and tour in Africa 6 times, and to Cuba to make a film and to play music there, and in Brazil. But basically, I'm a hometown Richmond kid who happens to have been around more than a child's length of time.
You know, and I know you deal. You, as a matter of fact, you're probably the one person that I know that introduced yoga in the sense that you practiced it. I mean, when I first met you, you know, you were right there in it, and it was totally. I was in awe because I didn't know, you know, I wasn't really in tune with it at the time, but it was really how much you, it was just a way of life for you.
Yes,
what is
and
your
it remains.
Point?
I've been doing yoga for over these 40 years, but I've also been playing tennis. So I love the concept of your show, calling it a playground, because life should be a playground. And yoga has been a very important centering device for me. It is a way to remain physically fit and limber on a very practical level. It's a way to be mindful and to center on the moment. And it's also a vehicle to make oneself ready and open to what comes through our experience. So yoga has been very important to me. I've been doing it for longer than most people have been alive, I think. Now.
That's right.
So it's just a part of my life.
Funny because I was gingerly trying to say that, but it was so it really is. I'm awestruck by that. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody longer than someone. More, some of these artists out here are, you know, have been around. You know, and you talked about the moment. Speaking about that, forever in the moment. Where did you come up with that name? Because the song just really goes deep.
Well, I appreciate you appreciating the song, and I the concept of having forever being in any one moment is a concept that is kind of yogic, if you will. it is the concept of living your life such that every moment is important. It's the same. It's a similar concept as an image that I have read that everything that is in the universe is in us. Everything that's an ocean is in one drop of the water. All of the principles, all of the makeup can be in one small part. Concept is important to me because I tend to live my life from the macro, meaning I tend to always gravitate toward overview and looking at a kind of a universal conceptualization. But it's also equally valid to look at life from the micro up. And one of the things that I believe is that we as mankind, as humans, we are sort of right in the middle. We are the exact middle size. We could go infinitely large above us and infinitely small below us, but we are right there in the middle. And it gives us a great vantage point to experience either the micro and then magnify that to the macro, or first experience the universal and condense it down to our own individual experience. And, you know, that's sort of what the concept of the title of the piece is. And I sort of agree with you. I co-wrote that with an artist whose name is Howard Bossaw, who's a much younger man than I, but who grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and he returned to Richmond having some great life experiences playing with other jazz musicians. And when he came to work with me, he hadn't written any songs, and so we worked on that song together. And I love the concept, and I love the chords that he developed and the melody came together to make one whole. But we tried to express the concept of this beautiful moment that you hear there being expandable to all the moments, like forever.
Yeah, well, you did a good job. You did a damn good job, but anyway, or a heaven good job.
Good.
What is it? So yeah, music, because that like I said, that really heals me. Okay. And so what, and this theme, this is about how important, how sound has been, it's kind of taken for granted. People enjoy it. They dance.
Sure.
They, you know, they sing
sure.
with the songs and everything. But you know, talk about your viewpoint on the importance of music in healing, you know, healing for the soul.
Yeah, and you've touched on something even in your introduction to that question, and that is that music fills lots of different purposes. Sometimes music is a party, a vehicle for partying, a vehicle for uplifting spirits, a vehicle. Sometimes music can marshal our energies so that we are ready to do any of our human endeavors, from going to war to worship. So music has many repercussions, many aspects, and one of those aspects is that some of the people from the Middle East introduced the concept of music being a healing force of the universe. And I love that phrase. Music is something that's universal. There is no culture on our planet that doesn't have music. Music is like a second language to us. But music has the ability to touch our psyche. And those of us in modern thought know that there is a mind-body connection. And if our minds are at peace, then our bodies have a chance to be at peace. If we first heal our mind, we can heal our bodies. And so music has that ability to put us in a great spiritual space, a peaceful space. It has the ability to let us know that we can do almost anything, including heal ourselves or allow our bodies to heal by being in tune. Which is a musical concept, but by being in tune with our surroundings, being in tune with nature, being in tune with the whole universe. So music is it has that potential. I don't think that the phrase means that all music is healing, but our intentionality influences what we do as humans. So if we play a piece of music and we intend for it to be healing, then it will demonstrate some of those aspects. And so I have, because I've been doing this for almost 50 years, I have dabbled with and tried to use various aspects of music, one of which is the concept of healing through music. But I also, on the other end of the spectrum, I also play party music so people can get down. I play music that tries to encapsulate our history so that people can learn from the music. I love putting words to the music so that the piece that you played a minute ago, Forever in a Moment, had no words, and that allows people to interpret that piece in the way that they like, or the way that they see, or the way that serves them. But I also love music that combines words so that we can help shape people's thought patterns or the information that we're giving them. So I consider myself a lyricist as much or more than I am a musician. I'm a musician almost by default because I've been playing the saxophone for 50 years. So maybe up to year 49, I wasn't qualified, but now that I've arrived to today, I'm a musician. I'm a seasoned musician, but I'd also like to think of myself as a poet and a lyricist as well.
Yeah, and I agree with you totally that some music is not healing, and it is in the eyes of the hearer.
The hearer, yeah.
And who takes it on, because it is the same as when someone is speaking and what they say, and it's not, you know, sometimes you might say, well, it's not what you said, it's how you say it.
Absolutely.
You know,
right.
or such. So it is about that sound in totality, and how it actually affects people in their minds and their hearts. So I am totally there with you on that. So tell me, what is the first piece of music that you ever played, and who inspired you to become a musician?
Well, I don't remember the first piece of music that I played. I'm probably going back further than you intend, but I started playing the piano when I was very young, maybe 5 or 6 years old. And I demonstrated in school a musical talent, if you will, or a musical talent. And my teachers recommended that I take music. And so in the fifth grade, I got a clarinet. And I played clarinet through my whole elementary and high school education. I had the chance to, I took music in Richmond Public Schools, And I had a chance by middle school to play several other instruments. I played the oboe and the bassoon. I played the timpani drums. But clarinet was my primary instrument. And by high school, I was the concertmeister of the concert band, and I was the president of the marching band. And there were numerous classical pieces. Most of the pieces that I played early on, the pieces that my educators used to teach us music, were basically European classical music. I remember playing March of the Toys on piano when I was about 6 years old, and everybody marveled that I was able to read that sheet music and play that piece after only a few piano lessons. But having said all of that, music was my second love when I was growing up. I never intended to be a musician. I never thought that I would be a musician. I grew up thinking that I would be a chemist. At 9 years old, I found my father's beginning college chemistry book and started reading it from page one and just fell in love with the concept of science and atoms and how compounds would react with one another to create new things. And I grew up thinking from that time on that I would be a chemist. In Richmond, Virginia, there was a very large DuPont plant near where I lived, and the sign out in front of that plant said, "Better things for better living through chemistry." And I really took that little motto to heart, and I said, okay, well, that's what I want to do. I want to grow up and invent things for people to be able to live better. I'll invent some new compound, some new plastic that can be used in some special way. And that's what I thought my life would be about. I left Richmond to go to Columbia University in New York, an Ivy League school. I was privileged to be recruited to go there, and I went there with the intention of being a chemist. But music was with me all the time. When I was in college, I started a soul music band called the Soul Syndicate on Columbia's campus. And Columbia University, people who are listening around the world may not know that Columbia University is based right in the heart of Manhattan, New York, New York. And I went there long before you and others were born. I went there in the 1960s. And New York in the 1960s had all of this music. It was and it remains a very exciting place for the arts and music in particular. But when I was in New York, you could hear on any given night, you could hear James Brown, you could hear John Coltrane, you could hear Bob Dylan, you could hear rock, soul, jazz. Every kind of music that was in existence would come through or be a part of the New York music scene. And that was a bit too much for me to resist. And so my second love, which was music, became my first love. And after 3 years, I left Columbia to pursue a music career. Now, all of that was a long thing to say. I don't remember the first song that I played. But I can say that I have been inspired, one, by everybody that I've ever heard play a saxophone. That means from beginners all the way up to my favorite saxophonists, who include people like John Coltrane, who I would name first, and second, Pharoah Sanders, and third, Maceo Parker, who used to play with James Brown, and all of the other saxophonists that I've ever heard, Joe Henderson, Grover Washington, Coleman Hawkins, and on and on. But I've also been inspired by other musicians on other instruments, and mainly by people who exhibit the talent to show that music is more than a pastime. So the reason I named John Coltrane first is because he was a jazz musician who won Downbeat's a poll as the best saxophonist. And then in his career, he shifted from playing straight jazz music to exploring jazz as a spiritual music, as a meditative mantra type aid to delving into our inner core. So he's somebody that inspires me. Likewise, there are African musicians like Nigerian King Sunny Ade or Fela Kuti. Fela Kuti is a Nigerian musician who played Afro beat music. He's passed away now. But I love Fela because he used his music as a vehicle to challenge his government. That's a very practical application for music. But he tried to inspire Nigerians and people around the world to get involved politically. So I like people I'm inspired by musicians who use music for things to entertain people, but also to educate and inspire people.
Wow. Well, that was really a mouthful. And I'm going to say this. You are a chemist.
Yeah.
You listen, anybody who knows your music knows that you are a chemist.
Yeah,
okay?
I do combine genres and combine things, sometimes disparate things. Sometimes I'm mixing chemicals in ways that haven't been done so often before.
Absolutely, and our chemicals in our body, the alchemy, you know, I love alchemy, and you do that. You do that, and you are that for me. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, you mentioned the 60s, so since you did, I want to talk about, you know, politics and just a bit of your political activity around that time.
Sure.
Okay?
Absolutely, great.
All right, be right back.
All right.
Life Conversations Radio. Be the change you want to see.
Hi, I'm Mark Victor Hansen. I want you to be listening to Life Conversations. My friends are running it, and they do the best hosting on the planet. Enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Jack Armstrong, author of Lessons from the Source, a spiritual guidebook for navigating life's journey. You're listening to Life Conversations Radio.
Are you about work, 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 and no play? Adults have a tendency to stay busy and neglect their own health and well-being, while successful people take regular breaks, vacations, and timeouts to play, rest, rejuvenate, and tap into their creative selves. Play and Heal is a unique opportunity for you to host a life-changing event in your very own living room. An event that is especially designed by you to facilitate the releasing of stress, balancing the mind, body, and spirit, not only for yourself, but of your friends and family too. Whether you create a soiree, a ladies' night, or couples event, these events are infused with the best of care, informative health information, and tools for stress maintenance that will shift how you see yourself and empower you to begin to work in cooperation with your best life. This event is sure to put a smile on your heart and send your spirit soaring. To book your Play and Heal event today, go to playandheal.org or you can email us at info@playandheal.org.
Click-a-doodle, shortbread, fudgy nut bar. How many treats? Click-a-doodle, shortbread, fudgy nut bar. How many treats in the cookie jar? One.
Dad, you're supposed to jump over the rope.
One more time.
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 1-877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Life Conversations is dedicated to empowering its listeners spiritually, emotionally, socially, and financially. The radio show provides the platform for the stimulation of thoughts, conversations, and ways of being that allow listeners to explore and examine what it is they believe and decide whether what they believe is keeping them stuck and disempowered or empowering them to live their best life.
Life Conversations Radio. Be the change you want to see.
And we're back with J. Plunky Branch, my wonderful comrade, my beautiful, beautiful friend. Plunky, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Yes, indeed. So let's talk about the 60s. Because, you know, that's a powerful time. And when people think about the 60s, what do they think about? They think about the Civil Rights Movement. They think about Martin Luther King. Give us your take, because you were in college, and that's when everybody was, all the college students, they were doing their thing.
Yes,
were you
absolutely.
One of them?
absolutely. In fact, I have to say this. I was at Columbia University, and Columbia was one of the first campuses to erupt in what we would call student revolt or student rebellion.
What?
Yeah, Columbia might have been the first on a major scale. It was one of those places where the students took over the administration building, held a dean captive for a minute, and that revolt was eventually put down with 1,000 New York policemen coming on campus, and it was quite an upheaval, and it set the tone for places like Berkeley and Kent State and others. You are so right. The 60s was a time of, I'm going to say upheaval. It was a time of opening awareness. It was a time of political movement. And I happened to be in college just after the sit-ins started and the voter registration movements in the South, and during the time that I was in college, there was the great debate among black students of nonviolence and the push for, quote, integration versus and that was epitomized by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and versus the concept of revolt or revolution or demanding justice by any means necessary, which is a phrase coined by Malcolm X. And those two trains of thought ran through the 60s. Dr. Martin Luther King inspired people to follow the lead of Mahatma Gandhi and strive for social change by a method of civil disobedience where you broke what was a law but accepted the penalty, and oftentimes those laws would be considered unjust, and the penalties would be considered unjust. And his concept, in a nutshell, was that people's consciences would get to them and say, this is just patently unfair. And that's what he did, and he led many of our students and people like me to follow him. But likewise, people like Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael and A-Trap Brown and others who were determined to try to push for change in other ways, in additional ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those methodologies reinforced one another. There are some who believe that Martin Luther King wouldn't have been as effective if there were not a Malcolm X or a Black Panther as the alternative. And so sometimes power only cedes to the threat of other power, and sometimes the power that they cede to is a power of over consciousness. And so, yes, all of that's me trying to be deep, but basically I lived through a period where the students were brought to the forefront. It was young people. Dr. Martin Luther King himself was a young man, but his followers, the people who were on the front line, were oftentimes young people. It was the students, and at people at Columbia, the students at these colleges, one of the reasons that they were so important was that they were the people who were being educated. They were the people who had some intellectual standing. They were the people who could not only put their bodies on the line, but also intellectually defend what they were doing or make demands in an intelligent way. So the students were extremely important. And because I was at Columbia, I was caught up in the political activity. I came from a small town of Richmond, Virginia. And when I got to Columbia, I knew nothing but whatever they said on CBS Evening News. I wasn't very well versed in the ways of the world and particularly in politics. But while I was at Columbia, I was educated. And beyond that, I was in some ways indoctrinated to a more progressive way of thinking in terms of what we as people could do when we group together, whether we group together under a governmental banner or any kind of organized movement toward what's right. And I have spoken in these last 2 minutes about the Black perspective of politics in the 60s, but there was a parallel movement among young white students as well. Their movement was mainly motivated by opposition to the Vietnam War, which was raging at that time. And Columbia was largely a white institution. When I arrived at Columbia as an undergrad, there were out of 800 students, there were only 16 Black students. And those 16 Black students in that freshman class doubled the amount of Blacks who were at the school at that time. So we're not talking about a Black institution. We're talking about maybe 32 Blacks out of 3,200 students at Columbia. And Columbia's revolt went up over two facts. To get Columbia to disassociate itself with the military industrial complex, and over the fact that Columbia was going to build a gymnasium on some adjacent land that was a part of Harlem. And so we had these twin tracks of the white students wanting to end the war and end Columbia's association with the Army, and the Black students wanting to block the building of this gym, and those things coming together in opposition to the campus administration, and the students took over the building, and as I said, we took over several buildings on campus, and it ended when they brought a phalanx of 1,000 New York police to empty the buildings. There were lots of arrests, lots of injuries, and that was, my experience with the front lines of the politics of that era.
Wow, that's rich, because you answered most of my questions in that because you know, as you were talking, it sparked some thought, you know, about sound and how powerful Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael. Somebody just asked me last night about Malcolm X, and I was giving them a little bit about him, and just their power of their voice, and how their word sound came out, and how it affected people. Like you talk about music, it affects different people in different ways, the resonance, the sound. What is it that people are intending on feeling or hearing or using? Mm-hmm. And then you take the parallel around that time. Wasn't that the time when the children, you talk about the youth, you know, were leading? Was that the time the children in South Africa were dancing and singing and bringing themselves towards freedom?
Absolutely. You said a lot in your sentence too, or your sentences as well. It was the 60s was a cauldron, was a boiling pot of emotions and sounds. You mentioned Stokely Carmichael and others who spoke. Well, I had the opportunity to hear Malcolm X just as a corner preacher in Harlem, who he would speak out in front of the mosque and out in front of the Apollo Theater, and large crowds would gather to hear him basically preach his message right out on the streets. And you're right, it was the power of his voice. But at the same time, it was the power, you have to understand that musicians do two things. Musicians help lead us. Artists in general help lead us. They also reflect their own times. They reflect their surroundings. And so in the 60s, there was the blossoming of a kind of message music. Message music in jazz and in the high arts. So that's where people like John Coltrane come into play, where he's playing this avant-garde screaming saxophone, screaming for attention. He's mimicking the voice of the people who are screaming for change. He not only does that through the sound of his saxophone, and the saxophone happens to be my instrument, so I would brag on it and say the saxophone happens to be the instrument that has the most human vocal quality. It sounds like a voice. If you hear a tenor saxophone, it's a tenor voice that you're hearing. If you hear a soprano saxophone, it sounds like a woman's voice. It takes on a vocal quality. And these musicians in the jazz realm were playing what was called then new music or creative music, avant-garde music. They were charting new territories. They were demanding to be heard in a different way, with a different tonality. It was a scream. It was a demand to be heard. At the same time, in other genres of black music, there was the message music of people like Curtis Mayfield, who was writing songs like "People Get Ready," "There's a Train a-coming," "Get On Board." There were people like James Brown who was saying, "Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud." There were people like Marvin Gaye asking the question, "What's going on about these wars and this destruction going on?" There were people, and I could probably name 100 songs during that time frame. The OJs having an album called "Ship Ahoy," and it talked about the slave ships Love Train, everybody get together. So the music was reflective of the times. It was reflective of the leadership, and it became the bridge from the leaders to the masses. The leaders would say these things, and one of the ways that it could be communicated was through the musicians and through the music, because that's for the black community, that's always been our biggest platform. We haven't often own TV stations or newspapers or mass communication media. So one of the ways that we have communicated is through our music and through our art. And this goes all the way back to the African tradition. Black people are musical people. Now, as I said when we first started, everybody on the planet, every culture that I know has music. So I'm not making a claim that black people are the only people that have music. I am saying that traditionally, everything that was done in tribal life in Africa was done to music. So music was an inherent central part of the way we expressed ourselves. Culture is simply the way people do things. And in Africa, everything that was done to music. And so all of our existence, music has played a very important part. And the sound of the instruments, the way that they're used with high energy, with multiple rhythms, with multiple levels of appreciation and levels of consciousness, always having multiple uses. These are African concepts that we have shared with the world, and this is why our music is so important.
Yeah, that's real powerful. And we was But before I bring in any more of my my questions, we have had someone on hold waiting to ask you questions.
Okay.
So let me bring her in real quick so I can get back in and jump the double dutch.
Okay.
The double dutch.
All right, we have a caller. This is Celeste. Celeste, you have a question?
Yes, I want to say congratulations to you, first, Ambassa. Thank you for allowing us to play on a playground every Thursday night.
Thank you.
It's been a beautiful journey. And Plunky, oh, yeah, I have a question for you.
Absolutely.
Here's my question. Now, when I was growing up, we had DC Youth Orchestra. DC Youth Orchestra is still around, but it feels like arts have just been cut out of public school education.
Yeah.
What would you say to us out here as adults who understand the power and the magic of music? What kind of thing can we do if the government decides that arts is not important anymore?
That's a great question. And the first answer that I would say is similar to what I would say to any time we have needs from our government, and that is to take some action. And the action can be as small as writing letters to the school boards and writing and petitioning our government in various ways. Beyond that, I would say on a very personal level, saying what you said in the way that you said it has power because it was personalized and you said we as adults know the power of music and we have to continue to say that. We have to provide for our children the opportunity to hear music and not just the music that they hear on radio every day that is trying to sell them something, but to share with them music that is meant to uplift so that that can be a part of their lives. You are so right. Many school districts, many levels of government have seen fit to cut the budgets. Let me put it in a more positive way, trying to balance the budgets. Often what I think people like you and I would think is a misguided way to balance the budget by cutting the more creative educational tools. Music, particularly for some communities, music is a vehicle that will inspire children to be more interested, I'll put it that way. Music can be used in a way to teach. Most of us learned our alphabets by singing A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And most of the young people today listen to rap music, and if you like it or not, one of the things that we know about rap music is when you put words to music, they become memorable. Our children can remember 10, 15, 20 minutes of rap, hundreds, thousands of words when it's put to music. And so music can be a tool to help them learn. And so you raised just such a great and relevant point. Most of the states I'm aware of this ongoing battle, but it's a battle that's going on right now, on how to keep creativity in our education system. And, you know, the short answer is organize, write, communicate through social media, through editorials, to petitions to school boards, city councils, give them examples of how music can be used positively, and never give up, even on a personal level, just making sure that people hear music and let people in the children in your own home and in your own block and in your own families are made aware of how potentially useful music is and important it is to us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Plunky.
Wow.
You and Basa, congratulations to you again, my sister.
And thank you for calling.
Thank you. Oh, man. Lord. I cannot believe this hour is almost up. I should have did a two-hour anniversary show.
Well,
a three-year-old for real now. I'm stumping my feet. Huh?
Basa, it just means that I talk a lot.
No, it just means that I'm having fun.
Okay.
Time flies when you're having fun. It collapses.
There you go.
It's forever in a moment.
That's right. And we're having this moment. Well, the other part of that is
but it's never too late.
Yes, and it's never too late to do good.
It's never too late. We're going to take it out with never too late. But first, I want you to tell everybody where they can find you.
Okay, absolutely. Well, as is common, I have a website, and the website is plunky1.com. That's plunkyone.com. That's my website. And if you Google my name, Plunky, Plunky, you're sure to find me. There are about 25 to 50,000 references to the word Plunky on Google. Most of them refer back to me.
So you will have no problem finding him on this
absolutely
playground of life.
If you can spell Plunky, you can find me.
All right, beloved.
And remember, it's never too late. That's
the
name
go
of
out
my
with Never Too Late, and that's from your latest, right?
That's my latest CD. It's called Never Too Late. It's a CD that bridges my past to my future. It was done in conjunction with my son. It uses a lot of new songs, but some of the old songs from my albums from the 70s, he's updated, sampled, put new beats to. And we go back in and put new poetry, with the old sounds and the new sounds, and we've come up with something that we think is future music.
I love you. I love you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, and I'll see you when I get to Richmond, when I get back, when I click my heels and come
back
from the land of Oz.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. And you enjoy your playground. And I enjoy
being here playing with you. I love you, Plunky.
Thank you, dear. Take good care.
Alrighty.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, we're going to go out with Never Too Late. And yes, indeed, it's going to be soon time for me to click my heels 3 times and think of home where there's love overflowing. But right now, it's never too late to love. On Basta out. I'll see you next week. Hey.